Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May. I am joined by Taylor Ackerman.
Hello.
Michael Buzzy.
Hello, everyone.
Randy Olson.
Happy to be back. Hello.
And today we have special guests, Kevin Settle, who is the director and producer of a documentary film that we have been talking about for the past couple of weeks called Fruits of Peace. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thanks for having me back.
And last but not least, we're so honored to have Jeff Grubb here. Hello, Jeff.
Hello, Dr. May. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
But please call me Hope.
Okay.
No formalities whatsoever. So the title of this show is The Duty to Remember, How Nuke and Evelyn Grubb Helped Build a Community of Memory. And Jeff Grubb is the eldest of the four Grubb sons, which is part of this very big story that is told in the film Fruits of Peace. What we did last week, which I should mention, was a continuation. This is actually I think the third segment of a series that we began on POW MIA Recognition Day, which was on September 18th of this year. And we have been doing a number of shows fleshing out this story. And last week, we began with a photograph of U Pham, a Vietnamese national, at the grave of Wilmer Newland Nuke Grubb. We really focused on that picture, on the events that picture led to, and some of those events are captured in Kevin's film, Fruits of Peace. Today we are also beginning our conversation with a photo. The photo that we began with last week was taken in 2010. That is when U Pham visits the grave of Nuke Grubb. But we're going to go back in time today to 1966, which involves another photo so important. And as I try to wrap my mind around this story, which has taken a number of months, I'd like to say that there's like a number of, you know, artifacts relevant to this. And the title is, you know, includes this phrase, community of memory. So there's this 2010 photo of U Pham at Nuke Grubb's grave. That would be artifact number one. Artifact number two, this 1966 photo that we'll be talking about today. Artifact number three, a book that we've mentioned called You Are Not Forgotten by Evelyn Grubb and Carol Joes, that's published in 2008. And then artifact number four would be the Fruits of Peace film. And you can, there's a Facebook page for that film. You can access that on our show resources page. To get us started, I just want to recap a little bit what we talked about last week. And if you're interested, again, go and listen to that episode. I think it's episode 18. We talked about the circumstances which led U Pham to Nuke Grubb's grave at Arlington National Cemetery and how that moment blossomed into Fruits of Peace. And Jeff, I wanted to ask you, because you weren't on the show last week, but that photograph, that 2010 photograph of U Pham at your father's grave, eventually does make its way to you. And I was just wondering if you could talk about how that photograph was transmitted to your family.
Okay, the photo of U Pham, he had posted it apparently to the Arlington National Cemetery website that has the ability to post information about each person that's buried at Arlington Cemetery. My brother Roland had been monitoring the site because sometimes people leave comments and it's good for the family to respond. And there was this picture of a Vietnamese guy sitting in front of my father's grave. And my brother Roland said, "Who is this guy?" And I certainly didn't know. For a few weeks, or at least a few days, where we just didn't know who he was. I brought my other brothers, Van and Roy, into the conversation. None of them knew who he was either. And then we were contacted. I believe it was Kevin that contacted Carol Jost, the co-author with my mother on the You Are Not Forgotten book, and said, "Are you interested in who this guy is?" And then the rest of the story evolved from there. So it was a real turning point of a mysterious connection.
So is that in 2010 when Roland finds it on the virtual Vietnam Memorial wall?
Yes.
Okay. And so, and Kevin, can you also talk about your your version of that story?
Sure. As we discussed last week, my co-producer, Michael, took the photos of UFOM in Washington, D.C., not only the infamous hamburger dinner, but at the Arlington site of the headstone for Newt Grubb and Evelyn Grubb, as well as at the Vietnam Memorial Wall. But neither Michael nor myself were aware that UFOM had reached out to the webmaster for the Vietnam Memorial Wall site to have that picture posted. And as Roland depicts in the film, he had stumbled across the picture of UFOM at Newt Grubb's grave at the Arlington Online, and then went to the wall to only find next that UFOM's picture at the wall was on the virtual wall's website. So I can't recall specifically, Hope, if Michael and I talked about it, but I do remember doing the investigative work myself because I was wondering how these pictures got up there, and I sent an email myself to the webmaster saying, "Hey, by the way, I'm working on this project, and I know the families involved." I kept it really broad, and I said, "How did that picture get up there?" And in fact, the webmaster replied almost the very next day in an email and explained to me that who had sent it by name and email address, and sure enough, it was UFOM's email and name. And he asked, UFOM had asked the webmaster to post it up there on the virtual wall, unbeknownst to myself and Michael. So,
yeah, and as we discussed last week, I think Randy asked the question about whether when this 2010 picture had been taken, was there any real knowledge of the National League of Families? And there wasn't, but the name, like having UFOM visit the grave and Michael asking, you know, who is this person? And then finding the book by Carol Jost and Evelyn Grubb. So that there's an unlocking not only on that side for you, Kevin, and Michael and your team, but also, of course, for the Grubb family and who is this guy at the grave. So this gesture is bringing together these different streams of information. Before we move on to the 1966 picture, because we're just sort of still rounding out our conversation about the 2010 photo, I just want to open it up to anybody on the line if they have a question or comment about anything that has been said so far.
Thank you. I have a question for you, Jeff. How did you come to know who Ufam truly was? So you first sort of see him in this 2010 photo, and then was the information, did it sort of come gradually, like bits and pieces of who he was and where he came from, or was it more so relayed through Kevin and his team? I'm really curious as to how, you know, that process unfolded.
Yeah, to my recollection, it kind of came through Carol Jost, but it was Kevin who had reached out and Michael who had reached out to Carol to see if the family would be interested in connecting with Ufam. So,
thank you.
Yeah, and that I can't remember exactly how long after seeing the picture that was.
And Randy?
Yeah, it was so in 2010 the picture was taken. I went down to Florida to meet Roy Grubb and his middle older brother, Stephen, in I think August of 2014.
I just wanted to make a quick comment about like how tremendous a picture can be. Just one photograph set in motion such an incredible series of events. And, you know, I've taken a lot of photos in my life, and I've never once thought, like, I'm going to take this and send it to, you know, like, suppose I'm at a cemetery. I never would think to send the person responsible for that cemetery, like the picture. I've taken pictures of cemeteries. I've never thought to do that. So I just want to like briefly touch on the genius of Ufam for doing these things and setting these things into motion, because I don't know, that's some incredible invisible hand stuff as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Anybody else? So if I recall, when Ufam goes to the cemetery with Michael Chiplock, he has a photo with him. And I gather it is this 1966 photograph with the nurse. If you go to our show resources page, there's actually several different photos of Nuke Grubb. But I think this nurse photo is maybe the most notorious. But Can either Kevin or Jeff, maybe Kevin, you know this better than Jeff. I'm pretty sure that he does have this photograph when he, you know, talks to Michael about going to Arlington. Do you remember that coming up last week? I have a vague recollection of that.
Well, only in afterwards do we discover that the photo, you know, is printed in his in UFOM's C4 unit directory, their printed book, unit history book and directory. In fact, yeah, when he shows up with to meet Michael, there is not that photo. It is just the name, and it's when Michael gets back and gets on the internet does he discover about the photograph.
Okay. Well, Ufam had clearly seen this 1966 photograph with the nurse, because, as you say, it's published in the unit, the C4, and that was the anti-aircraft unit that Ufam was a member of that is responsible for shooting down Nuke Grubb's plane. We're going to talk about that photograph now, there's so much story connected to that photograph as well. And we're going to start talking about the story involving North Vietnam and the circumstances that even caused Nuke to be in that picture. And so, Kevin, can you speak to that?
Yeah. So answering when that picture was taken and the specific location is the subject of much debate. I think you'll see that played out not only in part one film, but part two. I believe the C4 unit and the Grubb family, however, have narrowed it down a bit to the fact that the picture was taken most likely the day after Nuke was shot down. So that would be January 27, 1966. And it is also believed that the location of the primary photo, when I say primary photos, because there's a series of photos, not only with this leading kind of nurse photo, but others. So there's this primary photo of the nurse tended to Nuke Grubb's knee, you know, and the location is, again, we believe, to be somewhere close to a tiny village called Song Trac, which is along the Song Song River in the Quang Binh province of northern Vietnam. But we do believe, however, that it's on the other side of the river from where Nuke Grubb was captured and where the C4 unit had detained him throughout much of the night from approximately 5 to 6 p.m. on 26 January to roughly 4 to 6 a.m. early the next morning. So the events, that's kind of like, now we get into the events that led to Nuke Grubb being on the ground. So, in fact, on the morning of January 26, 1966, then Captains Nuke Grubb and his wingman, Alan Brunstrom, took off on their sortie mission from Saigon in two separate RF-101 jets. They flew up the coast to a city called Vinh, which is the capital city of Nha An province. It's about 600 miles north of Saigon. And after covering Vinh, again, their mission is reconnaissance. They're taking photographic coverage of areas, targets. It was on their way back down that they turned, let's say, right and headed west along the Song Song River. Their destination was the Song Song ferry crossing, again, at that tiny village called Song Trac, which is a very important strategic crossing as part of the Ho Chi Minh Trail Network, which in Vietnamese is known as the Trong Song. There, at that crossing, the ferry was the center of intense bombing throughout the entirety of the war. In fact, there are many stories and texts and books about this river crossing and for what's known as the Disappearing River. It's called that because approximately a mile farther downriver or towards Laos, the Song Trac River flows directly into a large cave. And the cave is very cavernous and endless and continues throughout and even through into Laos. It's very important because what the North was able to do is operate the ferry at night, again, to get personnel, material to cross that large river. However, they were able to disassemble its sections and tow those sections into that cave about a mile away and protect that equipment, that ferry equipment, from constant bombing, especially during the daytime and at times of high visibility. So that is really what the circumstances are. In terms of the actual shooting down, if you would like me to continue, due to the clouds, both Al and Al Brunstrom and Nuke Grubb were flying in what's called combat formation, meaning they were side by side, about 1,000 feet apart. They were going approximately 500 knots, which is roughly 600 miles per hour, and their altitude was roughly 200 feet. Again, the cloud deck was very high, so they had to get below it. And they picked it up, the Song Song River. They were whipping and winding along the river. mindful that some very high, jagged mountain ranges are to their north or to their right at this point. And what they expected to find was some evidence of terrain either being disrupted by the operations of the ferry, such as, you know, material being staged or movement of equipment and trucks, or in fact, equipment being staged to make a crossing. Perhaps what they didn't expect to find, in fact, was C4 unit awaiting them with entrenched what's called 12.7 millimeter guns and set up in a diamond formation. We know all this information because we have perspectives from both sides of the event, right? So I have, you know, obviously C4 who are on the ground there, who say they picked up the two jets at about 1,800 meters away and almost immediately began firing. They were successful in striking Nuke Grubb's jet. And as Al Bronstrom says, all he heard on the radio was that Nuke say he was hit. And Al pulled straight up into the clouds, so not to create any type of strike of debris or the jet. And he had to pull up to about 20,000 feet to clear clouds to try to then circle back and look for the situation, more information. From C4's perspective on the ground, however, Nuke's plane broke in half, with the tail falling into the river and most of the fuselage continuing on into the mountains of Sung Truk. And they saw Nuke Grubb's parachute open up, and they watched Nuke Grubb descend into really the saddle of this mountain range, right in the saddle of two precipitous peaks. And then immediately, three different units set out to seek Nuke Grubb out in the mountains. Mm-hmm. It took them about 3 hours to apprehend him, and then they brought him back down through the mountains, and they brought him to their command post. And then it is that evening of the 26th that Nuke Grubb was seen and stayed overnight in not the village of Sung Truk, but a neighboring village along the base of a mountain, where C4, in fact, had been residing sporadically throughout numerous houses and huts along the base of the mountain, not clustered together. So if a bombing attack had come, they wouldn't all been wiped away with one attack. Again, that's on January 26, 1966. It is throughout the evening of that night that Nuke Grubb was seen by one of the villagers, his knee treated for what they described as very superficial wounds, however, just requiring some cleaning and bandaging. And they also fed Nuke Grubb several times throughout the evening and guarded him. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that. And as you mentioned, Al Brunstrom, I mean, he was eventually shot down, correct?
Yes, Al Brunstrom was shot down several months later of north of Hanoi in an area called Lung Song, which is a strategic railroad area, that a railroad that was bringing supplies from China to northern Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. And Jeff, do you want to add anything to this account?
I could just say from my perspective, this was all mysterious because I was 9 years old when my father was shot down. So from the American, from my perspective of living in Virginia, I just got word that my father had been shot down. My family was informed at a time when there was a lot of snow on the ground, and my brothers and I all were down with chicken pox. We were informed in the morning by a taxi driver who was bringing a telegram, and my mother opened the door and was informed saw the taxi driver, saw that he was carrying a telegram, and instantly knew that it was terrible news about my father. Mm-hmm. So from our perspective, we just didn't know what mission he was on. We didn't know anything other than that my father was missing in action.
Mm-hmm. And the photograph. We'll get to that. The moment that you're describing, of course, does not involve your mother learning about this photograph that we've been talking about. Yeah.
No, but that's leading up. That's leading up to the photograph.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My father then is in the position of missing in action, which is a terrible limbo for the family, for the members of his unit and the rescue people that couldn't get to him in time. But personally, it was a terrible not knowing, just an emptiness of terror and ignorance of what had happened to my father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're definitely going to talk about that wound of not knowing and how your mother takes action to remedy that wound, not only for your family, but for all families of POW MIA. So I'm really honored that you're sharing this account with us. And I just also want to open it up to the others on the call to see if they have any questions or comments at this point about the picture, the circumstances in North Vietnam that Kevin has described, and also the impact of the shooting down of the plane in the United States.
I have a question about the documentary Fruits of Peace, which is absolutely incredible, by the way. So when the part in the film comes to describing the shooting down of New Grub, the drone footage is showing sort of the mountain peaks, and then sort of there's this it's like lush greenery around, but then there's this sort of marred spot of, gray, brownish earth that looks like an impact. Was that meant to represent where New Grub's jet crashed into the mountains when he ejected, or is that just sort of a random spot that just I'm just like tying the two together and it's not meant to be related? But I was just curious about that when I had viewed the film for myself.
Yeah, so we did the drone coverage to almost replicate the flight path, as Al Brunstrom had explained it to me the year before. For a good stretch, obviously, we use it throughout the film as really a marker. But once we come over the peaks there, just with the village of Son Truc to our left, we see that rubble on the face, on the opposite face of one of those peaks that you just described. We don't know. That could have been the terrain there, or that rock could have been disrupted by bombs or some other crash, or the villagers are doing something up there. We don't know, because we weren't able to get up that far on foot in 2015 when when Ufam and the Grubb family ascended the mountain. They went up about three quarters of the way. So we don't know to answer the question specifically. It's anybody's guess if that is part or had been created by crash debris or debris from the crash.
Thank you.
I've got a question for Jeff. Jeff, I'm wondering, you know, psychologically, is it kind of surreal that for the better part of 50 years now, so many people are interested in the fate of your father? Because, I know that just strikes me as something very surreal, that having lost my father, it was something that I never would have thought anyone was going to notice or whether it was going to change anybody's, you know, lives at all. But in your case, it's like this pivotal moment in so many people's, in so much. I'm just curious, like, can you speak to that at all?
Well, I'm not sure I'd describe it as surreal. I do feel gratified in some way, that grateful that people care, not just about my father, but about all the missing and the prisoners. And we have lots of kind of unsolved aspects of this story, which I guess we'll get to later. But it's just, you know, our memories are tied up with emotion and the rigors of trying to put timelines on things and it's a very human story. So I don't know. I'm not being articulate, but I'm grateful that people do care and explore these memories with the family and still try to get to the bottom of kind of an unsolved mystery of what happened to my father.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Taylor?
I mean, I do have one question, and I don't want to jump off topic too much, but when speaking about sort of the pain of the missing in action, like not knowing what happened to him, you know, even when you find out someone's been dead, I've done some work with survivors or families who have disappeared, which is very similar to the civilians who've just been disappeared and they don't know what happened to their family members. There seems to be a desire and a peace to sort of understand what happened. And as you continue to like find out more about your father's story, you know, throughout the process with Nook and the documentary, or even before, are you finding that it's given you the answers that you wanted, or is it something that you're still searching more for? And if you could speak a little bit more on that.
I mean, this whole experience was remarkable, and it filled in big blank areas of my knowledge and understanding of what my father, who my father was, what he had gone through, who my mother was, what she had gone through, and you know, and the perspective is constantly changing as I age, because you know, as I have more experience, I can certainly understand much more. But the experience of going to Vietnam and meeting the people who had shot my father down, and spending time with them, talking with them, and then visiting the places that my father had been based, the places where he had flown over, the places where he was shot down, and walk on those grounds, and then finally going to North Vietnam and seeing the place where we believe that he died. That, you know, it. I don't think anything will ever bring closure. I'm not sure that that's possible, but it helps inform and bring a reality to the situation that had up till that point been supposition and guesswork and just impression instead of walking the land and breathing the air in that place.
So we're going to sort of do a little slight pivot to, we're still talking about this picture, and as I've mentioned before, when Jeff was talking about how he learned about the fate of his father's plane being shot down, and how the status is missing in action, and there's this great uncertainty and vagueness surrounding that. And I think it's maybe 2 weeks later or so that this picture that we're talking about is seen in a newspaper. And I'm going to play a clip now to get us into this conversation. You can access this whole talk on our show resources page. It's a wonderful talk from Carol Joes about this book, You Are Not Forgotten, that she co-wrote with Evelyn Grubb. And I also just want to point out that this book is published in 2008. And if memory serves, Jeff, your mother dies, is it in 2005 that she dies?
Yes.
Right. So this book, which I think, has done a lot for, for this team over here, obviously for Kevin's team, your mother did not see the completion and publication of the book. And I just think that's extremely poignant, and I want to point that out. But in any case, Carol Joes gives this talk, which you can watch on our show resources page. There's a link to it. I'm going to play a clip from it when she's describing the moment when Evelyn learns about this photograph that's published in a newspaper. It's about 2 minutes long.
After years of being ignored by the government, when Nuke was shot down in January of 1966, the wives were really told to sit down, be quiet, and keep a low profile, say nothing about their husbands, tell no one anything. Well, Evie knew that Nuke was alive because 2 weeks after she got that terrible telegram, her phone rang, and it was a fraternity brother of her father's from Altoona, Pennsylvania, who said to her, Evie, there's a picture of your husband in the paper today in the Altoona Mirror. Now, she'd heard nothing from the Air Force, nothing from the government, and here's a man that she knows well calling to say, yep, the commies have got him. The picture's right here in the paper. That's him. I'd know him anywhere. I'd know him from a baby, and I was at your wedding. And, of course, those were not the days of instant email or faxes or flash sending of things. So she had to wait until he copied that and mailed it to her. Meanwhile, she called the Air Force, who refused to confirm or deny anything. So she waited more. Well, this went on for years. She never heard a word from her husband, although you will see in the pictures in these places here, these are of Nuke, these are of Evie, and you will see the pictures of Nuke up and walking with a water buffalo in the front, perfectly fine, arms tied behind him, and a bunch of Vietnamese militia around him, taking him to prison camp. We do not know from that moment to this whatever happened to Nuke Grubb for certain. We know only that he did not survive captivity. Evelyn did not know that for almost 8 years, 8 long years. But meantime, she did not sit and wait, as the government had told her to do, nor did the other wives, to their credit. After years of being ignored, they decided to stand up and fight back, and they did.
Again, you can watch the complete talk of Carol Joe's our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com. And Jeff, can you talk about your memory of when that picture became known to your family? And that was one of several pictures, but that was the first picture that started to come out.
Yeah, that's right. It came as a revelation, you know. We didn't know if he was alive or dead. You know, knew he only that he was missing, and then there was this proof that he was alive, that he had been captured, and that one picture showed him being treated for a superficial leg wound, and subsequent pictures that came out over several years through various sources did show him up and walking. Good posture, upright, no eyes focused, etc. So it showed that my father was alive.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great news to us.
And so then his status changes from missing to a prisoner of war.
Right. I can't remember exactly how long that status change took. As that Carol's story points out, that it was the government didn't at first acknowledge even the existence of the photo, and it came out through unofficial civilian channels instead of through government channels. So, but yes, his status was changed to prisoner of war, POW.
Mm-hmm. And Kevin, can you comment on this?
Yeah, so the photos, the issue or circumstances around the photos, I think for the family and from our own research, is that we know what we see in the photos, and then what we don't understand is why they were released or trickled out over the years. For instance, And maybe it helps if I just give a little bit of a chronology, you know, after. So we have January 26, 66, but then in early February, I think twice around the 3rd of February, the 10th of February, there was what's called an FBIS recording, Foreign Broadcast Information Service. Almost all POWs made some type of recording. And then, you know, it's propagandized by the DRV. So there was the recording of that, and they heard Nuke's voice. And then on the 10th of February of 66, the DRV news agency actually officially announced that they had Nuke Grubb captured. And at the same day, the first picture hit the print news, and that's when the family received the call from the friend of the friend of the fraternity brother. And what is complex is then there's a second photo and a third photo all trickling out in February of 66, and then nothing until later in October of 66, and then even into April and November of 97, you have different photos coming out. Again, analysis from either the Defense Intelligence Agency or U.S. Air Force Intelligence or collective analysis from several agencies all felt that the photos were all of the same event, and that is capture either post the nurse picture, the primary picture, or some days thereafter leading into maybe a week. You could tell because The analysis shows that there's a slight beard growing, a little scruff in facial hair. And again, they're different photos. Nuke is seen walking through presumably a rice field, and there's a water buffalo. There's a kid on one of the buffaloes. There's different militia behind. I think it's important to note that C4 is in none of those photos. And in fact, as C4 looks through this and does their own investigative work, they realize that most of everyone in those photos are what's called civil defense. The province level militia, if you will, volunteers, and not C4, regular army. And then that was really it from a photo perspective. At some point, there was a film released called Pilots in Pajamas, a CBS special, or the CBS ran. It was a German-produced special, and it had a picture, one of those pictures in it as well. But I think the consensus is that all the photos were taken from around the same time, if not within a range of a couple of weeks. And Jeff, help me out if I don't have that completely accurate. But that's the feeling that I think C4 and that we found.
Yeah, I think that's right, Kevin.
And on our show resources page, we don't have all of these photos, but I think we have four of them. If you want to, you know, look at them and study them. Any questions from anybody else?
Yes. Concerning the photographs released by the North Vietnamese, do you believe that they were released as sort of propaganda to show maybe a humanity-esque side to the North Vietnamese, to sort of show them as, you know, magnanimous warriors in this struggle against the imperialist Americans? Do you think that was sort of the angle they were going for, or did they do it more so for a different purpose? I'm curious about that.
I think that's absolutely right, that it was done as propaganda, especially as we learned much later in our family's ordeal that the Vietnamese government said my father had died 9 days after he was captured, and we didn't see any of those pictures until after he had died. So it's the grim irony of treating a prisoner who is actually already dead.
So, yeah, the continuing, you know, trickling out of these pictures over a number of years actually, you know, sets up the false belief that he's alive.
Absolutely, and at that time, the North Vietnamese were not abiding by the Geneva Convention mm-hmm. of having their prisons open to be inspected by impartial parties, allowing letters back and forth between families and prisoners. And early in the war, they were actually parading prisoners through the streets in gross violation of the Geneva Convention. And then there was no accounting during the war of who had died, no official accounting of who had died.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this really goes to the work of your mother, Evelyn Grubb. And as we begin to talk about what she does, because as the Carol Joes clip says that, you know, for 8 long years, she didn't know of the fate of her husband. And so this photograph, the first photograph that we've been talking about, you know, it's a turning point in what she does. And Kevin, can you just give a little bit of background about Evelyn Grubb?
Sure. I'll give a little background like I did for Nuke, understanding that her older son Jeff is on the podcast. So Evelyn was from her family, the Fowler family from Butler, PA. It's about 50 miles north of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's what we would call, or nested right there, what we call the Steel Belt of America. She completed her undergraduate degree at Penn State, remained there as her then husband, Luke Grubb, was completing his undergraduate, and actually Evelyn obtained her master's in art education, which, you know, quite frankly, played or was used significantly in her work with the league. And then soon into early of 55, as they left Penn State together, Jeff, you were born in
1956.
They started a family in 1956, and in fact, over the next 10 years, while Nuke was really developing a promising career as an Air Force pilot, he and wife Evelyn Grubb were developing a family. I believe, if I remember correctly, Roland was born in France as the family was stationed over there. Typical military, definitely on the pilot side, where you bounce around to the various military installations and you get your 2-year duties. And Stephen Grubb was born in Germany. So then that's all from 55 to 66 to the date we're talking about. With the nurse and Nuke Grubb pitcher. We talk about taking action. Much of what UFOM and C4 has done on their end to look into this event, but in Evelyn Grubb's case, and in the case for many of the MIA POW families, they took action, and in fact, Evelyn worked very dutifully with the National League since its inception, which really they opened their offices in August of 1970 in Washington, D.C. Evelyn went on to become national coordinator the last year of the war, leading up to the end of the war in January 23rd, 73. That's, in fact, when her leadership post ended and a new coordinator took the duty. So. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. And, Jeff, do you want to add anything?
Well, there's all those time points, but it misses the incredible energy, the focus, the force of nature that my mom was. She was pretty astounding ability to go from being a kind of a stay-at-home mom of 4 boys to meeting with the president and Kissinger, meeting with heads of state from around the world, going to the United Nations to present the petition, and talking to anybody who would listen about the missing and the prisoners of war. People use the word tireless, but I know my mom got real tired. But she did not give up.
Mm-hmm. So we've used this phrase on our show many times, and the phrase is moral energy. And as Randy has said in earlier shows, that it cannot be destroyed. That continues to work its magic and has absolutely reached us. Thanks to the book that was eventually published, I was able to learn about about your mother, and then thanks to your family and Kevin, was given the high honor to look at her UN petition that we'll briefly mention at the close of the show. But I just want to say I feel that as well, absolutely. Reading the book and then reading the petition, a great person of moral energy, as I think UFAM is as well, and this is a story where you have these two different streams of energy sort of, you know, coming together and having the effects that we're privileged to be a part of. Anybody else? Questions? Comments? Okay, so we've talked about Jeff, you talked about how you first learn about your father being shot down. He's missing in action. Then this photograph is seen, and at some point the status has changed from MIA to POW. But you do get some information, although not from, quote, official channels, that he has died. And I believe that's in 1970, and there's Fruits of Peace shows quickly like a screenshot of an article. I think it's the same article that you can read on our show resources page that was read into the Congressional Record, I think in 1970. And it's titled something like Communists Inform MIA Wife of Husband's Death in Captivity. And so, Jeff, can you just describe, you know, this information that came to you that your father was in fact dead?
Well, the unofficial source was the group called the Committee of Liaison with Families of Servicemen Detained in Vietnam. It was Cora Weiss and David Dillinger, I think. It was in November of 1970, mid-November, this was a group that was able to go into Vietnam and meet with Vietnamese officials, despite the fact that we were on a wartime footing with North Vietnamese at that time. And Cora Weiss announced that the North Vietnamese had released the names of several American service members who had died in captivity, and my father's name was on the list. So I can't remember exactly how we got that news, but it came at a time when my grandparents were down from Philadelphia. My mother's mother also lived close by. It was leading up towards Thanksgiving, so it was a family gathering that the phone call came, and it was followed up by a casualty officer from the local military base, confirming that this announcement had been made, but there was no collaborating evidence presented, no death certificates, nothing that is required by the Geneva Convention, and it did not come through official government channels.
Right, so there's perhaps still some, because it's not coming through official channels, there's still some hope that, you know, this is not accurate information, I would
right,
think.
Right, right, yeah.
Kevin, do you want to add anything to that?
That was a full frame on it. You know, from a research perspective, yeah, there were groups, as we know, that went over and worked with the Vietnamese to have certain, I think, in fact, early there were two releases of groups of POWs. Often it was highly propagandized. In fact, in one instance, American POWs with Khoa Phan, Khoa Wisis group, was flown from Hanoi to Beijing to Moscow to the Netherlands. So you can imagine 1970s, that's you know, that's quite the connecting flight through you know, known communist countries, capitals. And in fact, I think reflected poorly on what they were able to do. So I think, you know, in net here, I think most people would challenge their methods. I think from my research and definitely listening to Nixon tapes, you know, the government wasn't very happy with what they were doing. And I think, you know, not only in Evelyn's book, but in other texts written from MIA, PO, or primarily with the subject POW families, there was some divide on, you know, I think for the individual family perspective, those POWs who were being released, the families were excited and probably just, you know, didn't really take into consideration the methodology. I think it was a very divisive moment in this subject. So, yeah.
Okay. Anybody have questions, comments?
Yeah. Well, I just might add that after getting that news in mid-November, my mom did call a press conference in Richmond, Virginia, to say that she would not accept the news that my father was dead until it was submitted according to the articles of the Geneva Convention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that story is described in the article that we have on our show resources page. And it's also shortly thereafter that this unofficial information comes that the petition to the UN is dated June 7th, 1971. I'm not sure when she began working on that and whether she was working on that before this unofficial information came. But I just want to read a quote from that where she says, "I am determined to put aside my grief, to dry my tears, to turn from bitterness and self-pity and begin a journey, a mission to force all countries to recognize and adhere to the Geneva Convention, which will ultimately benefit 1,600 missing men." This is described in the book a little bit about, you know, your mother's advocacy for getting countries to respect their legal obligations under the Third Geneva Convention. And that sort of really impacted me, hearing that advocacy. And so I just want to point that out, that the response here is to get governments to respect their duties under international law regarding this, and sort of waking up the international community to put pressure on North Vietnam to comply with its duties. I just leave it open to anyone to comment on that.
Yeah, I'll jump in. You know, one of the things that strikes me is, you know, Evelyn is unwilling to accept the news until it comes from an official source, and that unwillingness expands all the way into, and correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, the whole intention of the POW-MIA flag is to, like, resolve the fate of prisoners of war in the most complete way possible. And so her unwillingness to accept this information haphazardly, like it's not official, it needs to actually come through the channel that it's designed for this kind of information to move through. Otherwise, it's not acceptable. It's like it expands all the way into this symbol. And, you know, on this show, we have a tendency to appreciate flags as this physical symbol of memory. And I can't help but point out that I know that my first experience with this story began seeing the flag. I was like, okay, what is this? Why is this in the nation's capital? Like, what is going on here? And sure enough, like, over the next few years, like, that symbol has brought the whole story into my consciousness. And so, I just wanted to, I guess, point all that out. And am I understanding the symbol?
Well, I don't know if it's to resolve it more than it is to bring it into the forefront, right? The subject and subjects at hand, or, you know, that surround what it means to be POW'd or MIA'd. I'll just go back to, if I may, comment. So there was more activity around the idea that whether, you know, Nuke Grubb is on a list or is alive or not. There's a large effort by the league. It was led by Joe McCain, John McCain's brother, called the Discrepancy Report. And that report, and I think Carol says it best in the film, basically is the discrepancy between those known or either from word of mouth or photographic evidence or audio evidence on the FBI's broadcast to be alive, but their names do not appear on a list because the DRV was providing lists of prisoners here and there, incomplete. And so the discrepancy was a separate list that the league was managing and communicating to DOD with, saying, oh, wait a second. This guy was released because we had two groups of prisoners coming back, and other prisoners had escaped too from the southern camps. So they're bringing back names of known detainees. Also, there was these propagandized photo events. As Jeff said, at some point, and it was Al Brunstrom as a POW was marched. It was called the Hanoi March through the streets one night. And, you know, faces were seen and names were written down. So we were curating this list from multiple data sources, and it was called the discrepancy report. So it wasn't just one list. It was the fact that there was this consistent behavior that persistently was inaccurate. So, you know, you have to kind of pepper that with these facts as to why, you know, one person coming back with a list who we know is being used as a propaganda tool may not be looked at so officially, not only by DOD, but certainly the families. So it did make its way into the petition. And, you know, Evelyn worked very hard on that petition, as she says, as it's covered in the book, and she was able to get an audience. And you know, George Bush, who was then UN ambassador, and Senator Fulbright worked with her very closely, so Evelyn could cover her contentions that she wrote in her petition. But we have to talk, really, you know, we have to talk about the primary contention, right, is that the family has the right to know the truth with certainty when status is in question or when it is unknown. And so I think for Evelyn, her fundamental right to know whether, you know, Nuke Grubb is dead or still alive in any of the circumstances of either, I think is it's rooted in the articles of the UN when it pertaining to these subjects. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and she also makes the argument that it's rooted in the articles of the Geneva Convention, the Third Geneva Convention, that there are these duties to communicate this information, and that the ultimate destination of this information is the family. And so, yeah, the Geneva Convention also is making reference to the family. And I just think that, that understand that concept of that we have a fundamental right to know, because that's the language that she uses. So we're talking about, the title of the show is The Duty to Remember. And in philosophy, when we're talking about duties, we say things like all duties imply rights and rights imply duties. And so if I have a right to know, then there's a duty that the government or some government has to communicate this. I haven't thought too much about this, but I do think when we're talking about the duty to remember, the ethics of memory, building a community of memory, these concepts that, keeping in mind the right to know is part of this framework, sort of conceptual scheme around memory duties. And I think that's really interesting.
Right, and the UN, in their charter, makes that declaration, right? They say the family is the unit. It's the fundamental mm-hmm. group unit of society
mm-hmm.
and entitled to protection. So through that,
mm-hmm.
right,
wide
mm-hmm. as possible protection should be accorded to the family. And that's what Evelyn's contention is that those rights have been infringed upon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
It springs to mind talking about duty of remembering how difficult it was for my mom to write the book that she wrote with Carol. She was undergoing cancer treatment at the time, and it was bringing up terrible memories, but she felt it was really important that she put into words what had happened to our family and make that available to the world.
Mm. Yeah, thanks for adding that. So it's probably, it was also likely difficult just to recall the memory, but then to have the physiological, the physiological pain going on. Yeah, it's remarkable to imagine. And I remember in the C-SPAN video, Carol Joes, when your mother first approaches Carol Joes and says, will you write my story? And Carol Joes says something like, I can't do it right now because I'm working on another story, so give me a year. And then your mother calls up Carol Joes and says, the year is up.
Yes.
And so it's like, I need to get this done. And I just think that, that's totally remarkable. And there's obviously that goes to her moral energy and that sense of duty that I have to get this story out. I have to preserve it. There's something in it. And I think, exactly right. anyone else?
No, I'll let you. I just want to express double down, I guess, on gratitude for both of you being here and, including us as part of this story, because, I said at the end of last week, and I'll say again this week, that, this story has been a portal through which basically all of my understanding about the Vietnam War has funneled through. And it's really made a good, like a foundation block for my understanding about the relationship between government and military when it comes to prisoners of war. Like basically that entire story is built upon the memory of your family. So thank you, Jeff, in particular, for enduring that, but then Kevin for bringing it out in a film that makes it comprehensible for somebody like me who knew basically nothing until watching the film. So thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would echo Randy's sentiments about gratitude for both of you for being here and sharing your story. I think it's brought an important light on the issue of POWs and the importance of duty to remember and to inform, and the importance of that for the families in particular, and why these duties on states are so important for families.
Anybody else?
As I have sat and reflected on just this immense story, I cannot help but be drawn to Stephen Pressfield's Do the Work and his concept of resistance through life, that when you try to conjure up any sort of creative endeavor or put something out into the world, life and a counterforce will always rise to meet it and seek to not maim or to sort of dissuade you from doing it, but to completely stop you dead in your tracks. And that this moral energy that we've been talking about, that I think Evelyn Grubb and your family, Jeff, is just so emblematic of, like the pure representation of this, that you, regardless of, in spite of all of the challenges that arise as you try to put this immense story out into the world, that you continuously push through until you hold what he calls the stubbornness, that it's not perseverance, it's stubbornness. It's willing to dig yourself in and to continue to trudge forward. And I have just been, as I've echoed this sentiment many times, I'm so immensely grateful to have come to know this story, and it has truly embedded itself into who I am as an individual, and it is something I lean on as I seek to conjure up and fortify my own moral energy as I persist on through my endeavors in education and else, like endeavors elsewhere. So I'm very much grateful. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I think it is a natural place to end. We've been going for over an hour. And I of course echo all the sentiments and absolutely just hearing the details in Carol Jones's book about, you know, the moral energy, this sentence that I read, you know, I'm determined to put aside my grief, dry my tears, and turn from bitterness and self-pity and begin a journey. Just that act, that intention, that decision is extremely powerful, and it's an extremely powerful resource to call on. I'll close by mentioning Marcus Aurelius and his Meditations. The opening chapters, he begins by remembering all of the people that he learned things from, and this is done so that he begins his day with sort of like in the front of his mind all of the lessons that he has learned. And like for me, yeah, in moments of difficulty, I absolutely call on your mother's story, Jeff. I just want to also just point out, because it's brought out in Carol Jones's talk a little bit, and we brought it out a little bit last week, but just the kind of loneliness that she had to endure, because in Carol Jones's talk, I think she says, you know, like, because of the gender roles of the time, for your mother to be doing something like this, like even was questioned by your grandmother, and like, you shouldn't be doing something like this, and this is not what a, quote, woman does. And so there's like a kind of loneliness that she had to endure in doing this, and she's just sort of listening to her deep self, and I just, you know, applaud that. Does that, do you remember that, Jeff, a sort of...
Yeah. Stayed faithful to my father, and it was a lonely road.
I mean,
yeah,
banding together with the other wives and family members, you know, provided some community, but it was definitely a lonely road.
So, yeah, I feel that, I see that, and I just want to mark that as well, that that's the kind of thing that is involved here. And I just think that that deserves immense respect. We will close it out here, and there's a lot of food for thought. We didn't get to some of the other bits in today's show, including, I mean, Jeff, you talked about your journey, the pilgrimage that you took to Vietnam, which I think, yeah, deserves to be discussed in detail. So perhaps we can come back in a couple of weeks and talk about that. Thank you both so much, Kevin and Jeff and the rest of the crew. I'm going to say goodbye now, and that you have been listening to Virtues of Peace. Check out the show resources page on our website, virtuesofpeace.com. Bye-bye.
Thank you.